quasi-cerebral talk and tunes. This is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's what we've got cooking up this hour. Hey, it's Leslie here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're the campus community radio station broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, and we respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast on unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam First Nations. The show, Typically Tuesdays, is produced on unceded territories of the Catsey, Coquitlam, and Stolo First Nations. And at Typically Tuesdays, we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers of these lands. At the same time, we also recognize and honor the plights and lives of all colonized people around the globe, with today a particular attention to the horrors that are occurring in Gaza. I want to take this opportunity to express my solidarity, movements around Land Back, and also my solidarity for a free Palestine. Today's episode of the show is heavily inspired by Radio Al-Hara, which is an online radio provider. They recently did 12 hours of programming on Palestine, and it's called Until Liberation. You can find that actually on SoundCloud if you look up Until Liberation Radio Al-Hara. In the spirit of that and getting inspiration from that, today's episode of Typically Tuesdays is a little bit different, I guess. I'm going to be reading short stories and poetry written by Palestinian authors. So you're not really going to be hearing a lot of my voice in the kind of like conceptual sense today. And as well, our playlist is a playlist from Palestine and the Palestinian diaspora. For no particular reason at all. There's no reason why I'm doing this for the program today. But yeah, that is what's going to be happening. A pretty straightforward and simple program. Here we go, here is Tan Tan by Dana Salah. زي عنبر لبس العوق الماضي بيبقى قصص مفتوحة من دون الوقود بلكي بخبي بلكي تأني بلكي بليل ويوم رح تقعد مستني تتمنى ترجعني وانا فندن بلا موت
لما تهدم انفاق تملي حد جرحه تقطع الساق تبطل تهتم تبطل تشتاق تعطل القلب تتغطى الافراق تتهنى في الفاقصة تنزاج بقرص الدرس في فلاش باك قلب اتعتم فلت الاسلاك ادراج جناحه لونه اسود سمه بتودى
بلكي بخبي بلكي تأني بلكي بستنى الدور بلكي اللي بيسألني مش خايف من شري وانا بدن
طريق الرجوع
You're tuned into Typically Tuesdays here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie. This episode of Typically Tuesdays is heavily inspired by Radio Al-Hara's 12-hour programming for Palestine, which was called Until Liberation. You can find that on Google. I'm taking a page from them, kind of just using my voice to amplify the voices of Palestinian artists, writers, thinkers. Today, in the first part of the show, I'm going to be reading from a collection of short stories called Kitash. It's edited by Joe Glanville, published in 2007 by Telegram. If you go on the internet and you look up that name, it's going to come out with a longer title and is gendered. And I want to mention that because since the publishing of that book, there have been authors that have come out not as women. And here forward, I'm only going to be referring to that collection as Kitash. I'm doing this to honor the identities of the people who aren't women, who are involved in writing the collection, and to also share their writing because I think it's really brilliant and I think people should get onto it. This is a story called My Shoe Size and Other People's Views on the Matter by Nibal Tawabte. I'm free. I feel I'm saved at last. I throw my drained body into the safe little spot I've escaped to from the world of endless continents and lodge myself there securely. It is the realm of my size, though it barely contains me. I open my eyes as never before and shake my head from side to side with wild abandon. The stories and fingerprints of yesterday fall away with my curls. As silent as love, granules of sweat roll down my face like kind fairies bringing relief for a moment in childbirth. I hold my head high, like a flag that has long hung half-mast, but is hoisted up and flown with pride and victory by its children. With both my hands, I smooth out the map of my life and call in a weary voice that barely reaches my ears. I'm free. I look down at my feet, like an old invalid stunned by the sudden ability to walk. I rejoice like a child receiving a doll on a feast day and say to myself, I'm reborn. I feel as fresh as peppermint, as though I was born yesterday. My memory is as pure and clear as a pool of water, untouched by the blowing breeze. I stand before the world in dumb bewilderment, as though I've stumbled upon a whole new existence. The day before me is a blend of Eve's life in the Stone Age and her life in this age of nothingness. I run my hand along the contours of my body from the northernmost point to the southernmost tip and shout in that same voice you cannot hear, for I can barely hear it myself. I can fly. The horse of my childhood dream, I see myself riding it now. True to the dream, we gallop on and on over level ground until we reach our destination. I hear nothing but the sound of hooves. I see nothing but the never-ending horizon, dyed the yellow of sunflowers, the red of my lips. I feel nothing but a quivering desire to embrace life. I know for sure that I can fly and won't be brought down. I'm liberated. I won't be shackled. I'm reborn and won't die again. I have awoken and won't slumber anymore. The awakening may have come late, but what matters is that it has come at all. I thank the circumstances that drew me to him and him to me. In the same unexplained way, we come into the world and the world comes to us. This afternoon, I walked vainly down Jerusalem's Madbasa Street and entered his store. The world was ablaze with people and sweat poured forth from every direction. "What size?" asked the young man, his mind on one customer, his eyes on another, his hands serving a third. I quickly lowered myself onto a chair, then leapt up as its scorching leather seat stung me. There, in the large mirror in front of me, my action was reflected life-size. Struggling to overcome my confusion, I somehow managed to keep up my princess-like manners. 38, please. The young man, and an expert in women's fittings and shoe sizes, turned around and concentrated his full attention on me. Really? His disdain brought the vile, invisible walls that had encircled me for so long tumbling down. I could hear them collapsing. I watched him size me up and suddenly no longer knew myself. What size am I, actually? I asked myself. The man moved off, passing me, my distraction and my shock. He disappeared and then returned with the shoes in the style and size I had requested. I took the shoes, undid the laces. Memories brought back the past. I recalled how each time I bought shoes in size 38, I would walk around in pain for a time, then eventually throw them into the cupboard stuffed with shoes of all styles and colors, all of which are 38s. My feet are size 39, I told myself, not 38. So why had I insisted on buying size 38 all this time? The answer lay folded carefully in a corner of Amal, Sana, Samia, and Ida's special girls' meetings. We would all brag our feet were the smallest, the presumption, of course, being that there was a direct connection between shoe size and a girl's grace and femininity. I'd boast outrageously I was a 38, then fall quiet for a while, and occasionally admit warily that I was really a 39. According to this theory, Samia was the most feminine and elegant of us all, as she wore size 36, the size always on display in shop windows. We would undress in front of shop windows to discover the truth. I stood for a long time in front of the windows of Bennington in Washington, lost in thought. How much truth was really imparted there? If my coloring was black, would the mirror receive me kindly? Or do we only stand in front of mirrors that flatter us? Once, in a childish moment, exhausted by shoe sizes and walking bare feet in the desert of my life, I complained to my mother about the size of my feet. She gave me an adequate answer. But I was not satisfied. It's all proportionate. Samia is only 155 meters tall, so she's petite and has small feet. You're 170, so you have a bigger build and larger feet. I dismissed my mother's justifications, unconvinced and without giving her analysis much thought. I stuck with my own categorization. I'm a size 38, I thus convinced myself. It is incredible what we can make ourselves believe when we want to, in a sense selecting what we expose ourselves to, what we comprehend and remember. How we embrace some things and close our eyes to others and explain our visions from our own perspective. How we forget what we should really remember. In some ways, my relationship with this theory resembles my relationship with my mother. Today, in my simple discovery, having shed all former experience and sat as a spectator watching the film of my memories, I realize I could have been doing this all my life because I wanted to get as close as I could to the standard people set for the feminine ideal. Whenever I buy shoes, I would ask for size 38s, then suffer from the new shoes for at least a month until they softened or stretched, either this or I threw them into my pile of 38 size shoes because they were one size too small, but one step closer to the feminine ideal. The disapproval of the man in the shop shook me, my innermost being, and all the hang-ups about my feet I've accumulated over the years, my conviction about the shoe size, as it were. The situation stunned me. A lifetime of immense suffering and trivial self-consciousness about my feet. Why? How did this happen to me? Are there other measurements I should wear or should not wear? Should I expect another shock to shake me into discovering that some other part of my unconsciousness is leading me unawares? And you? Do you wear the right size? As this young man who entered my life for a fleeting moment, like a billboard that flaps every minute as I pass in the car, why did he appear today? Why hasn't he ever said, size 38? Really? Before. Why didn't anyone else who saw me limping in tiny shoes intervene? Why didn't anyone simply say, take off your shoes and you'll feel a lot better? Take them off and walk barefoot. And me! How was I able to purchase hundreds of pairs of ill-feeling shoes simply because they were nearer to the feminine ideal? Perish my idiot shoes, and perish the standards set for femininity and beauty. All my life I have suffocated my toes in shoes that are not suitable because the size is wrong. Do you think I can make it up to my feet by walking barefoot for the rest of my life and never yielding to shoe sizes, styles, and colors again? I pause with deference and humility and offer my deepest apologies to my toes and the balls of my feet, which have swollen from the pressure. I leave the shop wearing a new pair of size 39s with my old tiny ones under my arm. I decide to hang them in a prominent place in my house. Perhaps I will think of a creative way of displaying them that will not enhance their beauty or bring them any admiration. I'll put them somewhere I can see them, so I will never forget that lifetime of discomfort, swollen soles and squashed toes born out of my insistence for a size that was too small, but that would provide the opportunity for people to regard me as feminine. Here's more music. Here is Prozac by Dom.
شلوم شلوم بديش هالشكل بوقف ع حقي بديش الكرس بديش تكنسه خد ليبراليتك وحشيها زرق في ثقوب في قناعكم الابيض اوكي كي كي
اي اي تعت نشوف انا المنكوب فانا المندوب نايس تو ميت يو انا علوش هاد منجيل هاد منكوش عنا عذاب بدها قلع من الشروش بس ما كان بينا ولا دعدوش قبل بوش
الله أكبر واتفجر من سبونسر نفاق شغل عداد الإرهاب سبقين الكل بالكيلومتراج يمن عراق هيروشيما الصومال باكستان سوريا وأفغانستان لا تكتب لي روشتا
بديش تعطيني بروزا
كأبتي وحرة فيها
mind your business
قسمني وقطعني بلفور شلحني وشردني كله مستورد كله مستورد شغل اجنبي وانا بستنى وانا بستنى صنع بلدي علو علو التصفيق علو علو التهليل رحبوا في لورنس الانجليز هذا بطل هذا اديس لورنس العرب هو لقب مستعرب قديم مستعرب اسرائيل ولقب مستعرب حديث رحبوا يلا ارقصوا مع الرئيس الاحمق افردوا لبساط الاحمر اهدوا اهدوا الماظ الكوكب
يضربني بالصرمة شو سيناريو حقوق مرأة نفاق الشوفينية مش شرقية بل ذكورية كل واحد ودوره أنا بعالج قضية الشرف وانت عالج عندكم صناعة البورنو لا تكتب لي روشتا
بديش تعطيني بروزا
كأبتي وحرة فيها
mind your business
لا حالي بتقلم
لا حالي بتقلم
بنموتهم ليني وليه
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. My name is Leslie, and today we're reading Palestinian writing on the radio by Palestinian writers for no particular reason at all. Here's an excerpt of a story by Rhonda Girar called Barefoot Bridge. This was a story published in 2007, I just really love the humor in it. Girar is very good at humor writing. Here we go. We're on our way to Palestine, which Baba calls the bank, El Dafa, to bury my Baba's Baba. We'll have to fly to Jordan, then drive to this Dafa and cross a bridge. On the airplane, I take out a map from the pocket in the seat in front of me, and on it, Palestine is the country stuck to Egypt. So I ask Baba, why can't we just drive there or take a plane straight there? He tells me to be quiet and fasten my seatbelt before the stewardess comes and kicks me off the plane. I remember that his Baba died and I should really be quiet. I want to hold his finger like the times we walked along the beach next to our apartment, the mud squishing underneath our sandals, my hand wrapped around his hairy finger. When the plane is in the sky, my ears feel like there's a person inside my head pulling at them with a string. Gamal must feel this way too, because he's crying and throwing a fit. In Jordan, we take a taxi from the airport to the border. Baba sits next to the driver and looks straight ahead. I look at all around me, at the rocks sticking out of the mountains that fly past us, and the sand and the green trees lining the road. We go down a mountain and my ears finally pop. I feel like we're on a roller coaster, except we have windows. I ask Mama for some paper and a pen, and she fishes them out of her bag. I'd like to draw what I see, the leather in the seat in the taxi, the cucumber sandwich my brother half ate, Baba's stubble, the dry skin around his eyes, Mama's lipstick-lined mouth, her face, the faces of the rocks outside, the wind whipping in through the window. I realize I can't draw all these things, so I make a list of them. I don't write numbers or anything, just list the things I'd like to record. After I'm done, I give Mama the sheet of paper, and she folds it in half without looking at it. Now I wish the wind would whisk the list I made and place it in Baba's lap. Then he'd open it up and read it, and he'd feel better. Mama brings out a brush from her giant purse, which holds 5 years' worth of receipts and eyeliners, and she brushes my hair impatiently. I want to say, ouch, it's not my fault Baba's Baba died, but I don't. Mama's coral lips twitches as she brushes. I want to make her lips transform into a smile. I'll write funny lists for her. The taxi goes all the way down the mountain, the wind rustling through the glass and whipping through my hair, messing it up again. The car slows down and everyone inside seems nervous. I look ahead and see yellow and black stripes on something that looks like a gate, and there's a soldier there, dressed in green. My father gives him papers, and the man lets us out. We sit with several other families on benches by the road. Mama and Baba don't talk. I just look at the soldier and his shiny rifle. We sit there for a long time, then a bus pulls up next to us and we're allowed to get on. The bodies on the bus sway back and forth, and from where I'm sitting, I can barely see the people's faces. Our bodies look like the dresses and t-shirts I saw a few days ago, hanging up on the wires at the market. Two women start talking about what village they're from, and then they smile because they're distant relatives. The driver stops the bus at another yellow and black gate and steps out for a moment. I follow him with my eyes and watch him get a cigarette from the soldier who is coming up the steps. The soldier inspects all our passports with a cigarette dangling out of his mouth. He never takes it off of his lips. I think it's a neat trick, but I'm worried about the long piece of ash hanging from it. When the soldier is done looking at papers, the bus driver gets back onto his seat and drives again. We approach a bridge, and the driver tells us to get off. I ask Baba if this is the bridge, and he nods his head and pats my shoulder. Where we get off, there are many soldiers, boy ones and girl ones, sitting outside a gray building. I walk past a girl soldier and admire her long curly hair tied up in a ponytail. Inside, we stand in a line with our luggage. After maybe an hour, they check our bags, dumping their contents onto the wooden counters, and ask us where we live. Baba answers them and they zip up the bags and keep them, telling us to sit down and await inspection. I ask Baba how long all of this will take and he says, "All day," and looks over at the soldier. It looks like he and the soldier are talking, but they're not saying a word. I go to Mama and she lets me take Gamal from her and so she can rest. He's heavy, and I can feel him farting through his underwear. For a while, Mama, my brother, and I are separated from Baba. We have to go to an area off to the side of the building and take our shoes off. There are many other girls there, and they have their shoes off as well. There are women in pretty dresses, women in jeans, women in veils, women in short skirts, women in traditional dresses with gold bracelets lining their arms and blue tattoos on their chins, women with big bug-eye sunglasses and big purple tint eyeglasses like Mama's, women in khaki shorts and tank tops, all women with no shoes on. Barefoot. It's hot now. The sun in the center of the sky and the roof of the building is made of metal. The girl soldiers tell us to step into the makeshift corridor that separate into rooms resembling fitting closets at a store. The rooms are sealed off with cream-colored fabric. Inside the room, I take my dress off and stand in my white underwear and my pink undershirt. I'm almost naked and barefoot. Mama takes off her skirt and blouse and is left in tight underwear that is meant to tuck her tummy in and a see-through bra. She is also naked and barefoot. The girl soldier, I notice, looks like a boy, and I would think she's a boy if it weren't for her chest. She runs a black machine over Mama's body, and I feel embarrassed for her, who's naked in front of this rough-handed stranger. As though she heard my thought, the stranger brings the machine up to my armpits and runs it all over my body. It feels like a black snake. Then, Mama farts a huge silent fart that stinks up the fitting room and forces the soldier to leave for a few seconds. We giggle, and Mama says, "Give me 5, so I do. From the room next to ours, we hear a girl soldier yell, "What's this? Where?" "Bah, Kotex. In her Kotex, yeah." The girl who'd hidden her gold chain in her Kotex stands next to them, her arms crossed over her chest. "I don't have money to pay the tax," she tells them in Arabic. Mama comes out of the room and takes my hand. We go and look for our shoes. They're in a huge laundry bin in the center of the bigger room. I ask Mama why they're there, and she says the soldiers took them and x-rayed them to make sure we weren't hiding anything in them. "Like what?" I asked, dangling the top half of my body over the bin. I find cute sunflower sandals, brown shoes, pretty red shoes, but not my shoes. "Like bombs," Mama says, inspecting her beige heels. "And grenades." "But," I say, finding one shoe but not the other. "I thought grenades were bigger than a shoe." At last, I find the other one. Exhales a woman in jeans and skinny glasses. "The girl's got more sense than those blind ones." A few minutes later, the entire bin